Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 9th, 2019. Current federal tax developments brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week we're going to look at what's happened in the week of December the 9th going on with taxes. And a big thing that's been happening this week, as we'll discuss, is we've gotten a lot of final versions of forms, some of which will be a little more disruptive than others. So we'll discuss some of that. We'll also discuss the fact that the IRS put out this week instructions to agents regarding how to conduct Bipartisan Budget Act, BBA 2015, audits of partnerships. Remember, that's also coming up and fun. So it's an interesting week. We'll have a lot of things to look at. Here's a little bit different. I'm returning from the road this week. I was back in the area of Baltimore and Washington, D.C. So I'm just now getting back to being here in town and ready to go on with the programs. We do want to remind you, we do have some online Cal CPA courses coming up that you can register for at the Cal CPA website or via many of your state societies directly. Get discounts there generally if you're a member of the state society, so it's very good to go check there. On December the 12th, we'll be doing a course called Partnership Taxation Advanced Issues. That should start at 6 a.m. Pacific or 8 a.m. Pacific time, depending upon which one of the two broadcasts you're looking at. A lot of state societies will only do one of the two broadcasts. They'll do the appropriate one for the time zone. So if you're in the eastern half of the country, you'll get the early one. If you're in the western half of the country, more likely it'll be picked to be the late one. If you look at Cal CPA's website, they actually have both of them up there. So whichever works for you is fine. We also will be running on the 20th, Multi-State Taxation of Businesses. That also will be at 6 a.m. and 8 a.m., two starts, and same issue as before. Be sure to check your state society of CPA's website to see if they're offering the Cal CPA courses, and you can register for us there. Or you can also go to Cal CPA's site and make your registration at that location. Let's talk about what's happened this week then. For the first thing to look at this week is we finally got the final version of the new Form W-4 that was issued on December the 4th of 2019. The new Form W-4 is a four-page document, and it's meant to help us get around the issues that were created when we went to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and the concept of exemptions really didn't make sense. And I realized that we didn't have exemptions, we had withholding allowances, but roughly a lot of taxpayers made the equivalency of exemptions and allowances were the same thing, and they started working backwards from there. And to be totally honest, the old system simply wasn't very well suited for how we're now computing individual taxes after many of the changes made by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So, we're going to get a brand new form. The problem, of course, is everybody's used to the old form. Well, if you've got a really simple case, but by simple we mean essentially you're single or you are married and your spouse doesn't work and you don't have more than one job and you don't have any dependents, you don't plan to itemize, you don't really have any significant other income. If that's your case, then this is a really simple form. You simply fill in the top your name, address, city, state, put your social in there, and then indicate your filing status, single or married filing separately, married filing joint, head of household, check one of three boxes, and then sign the form and you're done. Well, okay, that's easy. What if you're a little more complicated? Well, you'll need to do more if you have more than one job, and if you're a married couple, that's normal. That's going to be true in most cases, that both spouses are working, so we're going to have to do a more complicated calculation in that case. We have to work with more than one job. We also have to worry, so we have to worry about that issue. We also have to worry about it if we have dependents and we're below the phase-out number. So we'll work with that. That one's actually not too tough, as we'll discover. And we'll also need to worry about it if we have significant amounts of other income that there's not being taxes withheld from. We have to fill that part in and work with that. If we expect to itemize our deductions, there's another worksheet for that if we're going to be doing that. Now remember, with the larger standard deduction, very, very few people are now itemizing. So we're getting to a much smaller group there. And then finally, if you just want more withheld, then you go ahead and you can make changes here. So if you do have more than one job, the taxpayer fills in worksheet, basically the worksheet found on page 3. It's called Step 2B, the Multiple Jobs Worksheet, and fills that in to come up with an adjustment to give to the employer. right? There's an adjustment for the withholding. And what we're really doing in many ways is computing the annual adjustment to wages withheld for this person. And then we're going to refactor that down to a per payroll. That's what the employer will do. If you're an employer, there's going to be very different. You're not going to be anymore going with filing status and exemptions. You're going to be going now with a little more detailed sets of numbers. You're going to be picking up the numbers from the W-4, and your software is supposed to use that and crunch that to come up with the actual withholding numbers for the employee. That means your software needs to be rewritten for this to work. So be aware of that. We have to have new software. So if you're not somebody that likes to update software very often, you're going to need an update on this one for sure. You can't just kind of hope that the past one works. Now, if you have more than one job, what they do suggest, though, is besides that worksheet, they really suggest you go look at the W-4 application on the IRS website. That's the best place to go to calculate a more exact withholding. And in fact, for anybody, that's really a much better site to come down and try to dial things in if you're at all complicated. But if not, you can use the multiple jobs website if you want to go that route. And if you have husband and wife working, or you have two jobs and they're pretty much the same level of income, then you can just take a simple way out and check a box here. It says I have two jobs, but I just want you to go ahead and do the two job withholding standard structure. As the IRS notes, that will actually be the correct number if, or correctly in IRS view, if your earnings are about the same for each spouse, because what will end up happening is they'll assume there's an identical amount on the other side. That's how it gets adjusted. But they will note that you'll probably be over withheld if the numbers aren't even with the two spouses, that there'll probably be an over withholding at that point. So they do suggest that, you know, if you don't have approximately equal earnings, so let's say one spouse has W-2 wages of $120,000, the other spouse has W-2 wages of $40,000, yeah, you probably want to do the worksheets instead of doing this particular check the box routine. That said, a lot of people like refunds, and bottom line is if they just want to get a refund and they don't want to do any of the work, then yeah, they check that box and, you know, probably will get a refund. That's the way it would work. Well, we hope it would work. If you have deductions, that's really easy. Dependents, I should say. If you have dependents, you're just going to basically figure out what the credit will be, right? $2,000 for the kids that are under age 17, $500 for every other dependent. Those are your credits. We just add those up, and that number is given to the employer, and that's going to be used to make the adjustment to each payroll's withholding. So we'll figure out how much to reduce your withholding to take into account you're going to get this credit at the end of the year. And then finally, there's another worksheet that you do on called Step 4B Deductions Worksheet that takes care if you're itemizing deductions, what you would do with the itemized deductions, how that would go, plus any non-itemized deductions. So if you expect to have significant numbers, either one of those, you fill in that worksheet. And then finally, like the old W-4, I can just say, you know what, I just want more withheld. So regardless of what you compute, I want to have more taxes withheld from my wages. Here's what becomes interesting. Technically, you don't have to do a new W-4 if you're, at least the IRS was saying over the summer, you don't have to do a new W-4 if you're, you know, if you're a continuing employee, you can just keep going on with the old system until such time as you want to change. But if you have a new employee, they're going to have to do the new 2020 Form W-4. Doing a new form makes sense if you want to get your withholdings right, because obviously the old system was somewhat odd, didn't quite work right, you know, worked a little weirdly. And I would say it probably makes sense to do the new system as well if you have a married couple and one spouse changes jobs, so they're going to have to do this new W-4. The other spouse probably should go in and do the revised version as well. Otherwise, who knows how this is going to work out. We have one side which says we have, you know, two spouses and jobs, falls all that stuff in. The other side is using the old exemption system and whatever number that managed to magically work to. Not too sure how that'll work out for them. But yeah, we'll end up redoing it. That said, we should have a lot of questions because this is radically different from the old W-4. And I realize most of you are probably thinking a taxpayer should never, ever, ever want to get a refund. In theory, the taxpayer, you know, in a perfect world, would either owe nothing or they would owe whatever they might, they would owe the amount necessary, you know, whatever it is that where they had MAD withheld, the least amount to avoid the penalty for underpayment of estimated taxes. And if they then owe $40,000, you pay that April 15th because, hey, you know, you get the time value of money. That's great. Accountants think that way. Financial advisors think that way. Average people don't think that way, including some highly compensated and some highly educated other people don't think that way. They simply do not want the refund. They don't want to owe money, and they see the refund as found money. And while they may understand, if you sit there and explain it to them, of course, that it's not really found money, because, of course, you know, they put that in there, that's great. But psychologically, they still want that refund. So don't be surprised if some people want you to work up and try to figure out the W-4 amounts to get them about the same refund as in the past. That'll be interesting because you can't just use the methodology of, well, you know, at, you know, just ignore a couple of whatever exemptions would normally come up. Just get rid of them. And, of course, people under the old system got very comfortable with how many exemptions they could be safe with and still get the refund they wanted. So, yes, you have to do that. The other catch, which goes back to basically an article I think that I saw Kelly Erbright on the Forbes site, pointed out that, yeah, it's crazy. You know, maybe it is crazy theoretically, but when you figure out how low interest rates are today, maybe they're not really giving up that much. And maybe, you know, it's not totally insane to just take the peace of mind of I'm not going to be writing a check in April, so don't worry, I have to worry about suddenly I have to come up with the money in April. Maybe it's better off to and have that for savings and use that for the vacation. And, you know, yeah, there are lots worse things they're probably doing financially than that refund. So go ahead, get counsel people for what they want. I think that's what we should end up doing for these things. Well, in addition to the W-4s for 2020, we got 2019 forms today. And one of the big ones that came out, the first one that came out, which was useful, was actually the new Form 1040. The IRS finalized that on November the 29th. They finalized Form 1040, Form 1040-SR, Schedules 2 and 3 at that time. We were still missing Schedule 1. Now, this does remind us that, therefore, we now officially, the postcard is officially dead. Okay, some people at Treasury will try to argue that it's not, that it's still really kind of a postcard, but A, it never was a postcard, and B, you know, theoretically, it appeared they had decided a postcard was half a page, and it's definitely now more than half a page. So, yeah, whatever that's there. And third, nobody liked the postcard anyway, so I wouldn't defend too hard and say it's still a postcard. You know, it is a reduced size, but of course, everything now does actually add down. The big advantage, I think, for CPAs, which drove most of us batty, was the fact that the adjustments to income did not come forward on the old system. You just had to take that number from Schedule 1 and just know you had to subtract it. But it would never show on the front of the return, which we don't like. In addition to the regular 1040, remember we have the 1040-SR this year. The 1040-SR is the version for seniors. And as we discussed when the draft came out, it's identical to the regular old 1040, except for two basic differences. All the line numbers are the same. No differences. Use the same schedule. You basically, there's no real restriction on the SR that if you use it, you can't do something. If you use the SR, you still can itemize, despite the fact that originally the concept of this is going to be like a 1040 EZ app for seniors. And so non-itemizers wouldn't, you know, it'd be non-itemizers using it. Now, you can itemize, you can do everything. It's all these stuffs together. The two differences are it has bigger print. And yes, people always jokingly say when I ask what do you think the differences are, you know, in joking, you say, yeah, they do bigger print. It's like, yeah, it's bigger print. That is true. And it has a handy dandy cheat sheet for computing the standard deduction at the bottom of the first page. And that, by the way, that I think got put there so it looks like they actually did use a full page so they don't complain that the print's too small, you know, and right. So they're going to say, we're not going to complain the print's too small, and we're going to still cut off on the same line as the regular 1040. So that was part of it. We also got two schedules. Remember, we're getting rid of, we're going from six schedules last year to three schedules this year. And so they released Schedule 2. Schedule 2 with additional taxes. It contains things like the alternative minimum tax, self-employment taxes, and other less apt to be imposed taxes. But they're all coming there. They're on the front page of the 1040. We also have Schedule 3. It has additional credits, and such as the foreign tax credits on there, which is significant, and payments that don't go on the front. That include things like estimated tax payments will be there. That's what's on Schedule 3. And those are our schedules now. We have three schedules, 1, 2, and 3. Why were we missing number 1? Well, number 1, you may recall, got a change made after first release. When it was initially released, Schedule 1 did not include the question at the top regarding virtual currency. That question was added in a later draft. And so, interestingly enough, when initially released this stuff this week, you know, on the 29th, which essentially was late last week, on Friday of last week when nobody was working, effectively, we thought nobody was working down there at Treasury, somebody was, you know, they didn't release Schedule 1, and that led to a bit of speculation that, well, you know, are they reconsidering the virtual currency question? You know, why Schedule 1 not in there? You know, you can come up with all these theories. But the reality was Schedule 1 came out on the 5th, and we just waited not quite a week to release Schedule 1. So the final Schedule 1 did come out, and the big takeaway of this is the virtual currency question remains as it did in the draft at the top of the return. So you're still going to be asked about whether or not you've done anything with virtual currency. The actual question is, at any time during 2019, did you receive, sell, send, exchange, or otherwise acquire any financial interest in a virtual currency? Now, like it or not, this does mean you're going to have to ask your clients about this question. And by the way, I totally agree that there's going to be a large chunk of your clients who have no idea what virtual currency is, and you're going to spend time explaining it to them. Well, good news is, if they have no clue what it is, the odds of them having any are pretty low. But secondly, you just have to kind of tell them what's there. If you say the word Bitcoin, it's like, oh yeah, that stuff, I don't understand it. Yeah, well, you haven't got it into anything. No, I haven't got anything like it. No, I don't understand it. Which point then, dang, check the box no and you're good. But key, some of you may think, though, we know why the IRS is asking for this. The IRS got information from Coinbase about, you know, the number of people that had accounts and the accounts that had sales and things that went on, that theoretically, remember, if you have virtual currency and I spend the virtual currency to buy something, I should report that as a sale. If I converted my virtual currency to cash on Coinbase, that was a sale, so should have had Schedule D reporting. The IRS has stated multiple times in the past year that they know that they said just based on what they know from what they've got, there should have been a whole lot more reported Bitcoin transactions than the actual number reported. In fact, the IRS's perspective is they believe, you know, the actual compliance rate here is insanely low. So they have added the question to the return. Now, question becomes, do we have to answer it? Well, yeah, you're going to have to. Let's go to what it is. Why do you have to answer the question? Well, effectively, for CPAs, the answer is going to be pretty easy. Statements on Standards for Tax Services number 2 tells us flat out, a member should make a reasonable effort to obtain from the taxpayer information necessary to provide the appropriate answers to all questions on a tax return before signing as a preparer. That's the Statement of Standards on Tax Services number 2, second paragraph. Now, you may say, oh, wait a minute, said member there. I'm not a member of the ASCPA. I don't pay dues to them. Well, that's great, except in a lot of states, the state board has either openly or effectively adopted the AICPA ethics standards and related standards. And therefore, anytime it says member, they just swap that out and say a fill-in-the-blank CPA. For instance, here in Arizona, that's literally what the standard now says. Our regulations say that you just go back in and, you know, members mean an Arizona registrant. So Arizona CPAs would automatically have to comply with this rule. And as I say, that's going to be true in a lot of states. It's not just a couple of states that have followed and said, we're going to do the AI, you know, we do AICPA following. Many states have done that, so we now have AICPA rules that apply in a whole lot of states. This is not just a limited number, so there's a real good chance your state applies the standard regardless. Goes on to make a couple other comments. It does say as part of it, you may go, aha, this is it, this covers me. You can omit a, you know, there are some cases where it's reasonable to omit an answer. And it gives a couple of examples, but then it goes on to say, a member should not omit an answer merely because it might prove disadvantageous to a taxpayer. The fact that your client doesn't want to answer the question will not by itself be sufficient. Now, if they don't want to answer the question, and they want to try to claim like Fifth Amendment style issues, that's a whole nother mess. That's one where you don't even want to know the beginning of what problem they've got there. Obviously, there are ways of getting Bitcoin is very useful for certain highly illegal acts and to try to keep them off the books. So those things you do not want to know about, they should seek legal counsel, and after legal counsel, they explain to legal counsel what their problem is. Then legal counsel may decide if they can talk to you. Don't let them talk to you first. The problem with that is whatever you hear, you cannot unhear, and you could quickly become the key witness in a criminal trial, which you really don't want that to happen. It causes you problems, etc. Other problem you've got, let's say you do decide maybe that you could meet the standard to omit the answer. You're warned that you should consider the fact that omitting an answer could cause the return to be deemed to be incomplete or could subject somebody to penalties. And this is a real issue here. Why is the IRS adding this question? Well, let's get to a couple of issues. Let's start first with that incomplete issue. We've had cases in the past, 1 year ago involving Deutsche Bank, where the court has held, this was a court of claims, that you have to fill in the forms in accordance with the instructions. That's a requirement in order to have effectively filed a return. In the case of Deutsche Bank, they had left off some withholding statements by accident. The IRS noticed the one attached. They sent it back. This was for foreign corporation. And why that became important was it took the IRS longer to issue the refund than they should have. Deutsche Bank thought they should have gotten interest, and the court said no, the original return as submitted was not processable because you hadn't followed the instructions. Same issue here. You don't follow the instructions, the IRS could claim a return was never filed. But the other probably bigger problem is, and I think the reason why this is here is pretty obvious, the IRS has had really good success the last couple of years in getting the courts to rule the taxpayers have willfully failed to file the FBAR reports. When the tax returns have not disclosed the fact they needed to file FBAR reports on Schedule B. You know, now taxpayers have tried to argue that, wait, I just got that from the CPA. I didn't realize the boxes were checked. I never read that, so I didn't even know about the FBAR thing. And the courts have rejected that theory every time. Clients, taxpayers have a responsibility to review the return and read the return. And the courts also say that those questions about Schedule B, this is not exactly a highly technical thing they're telling you. They're saying, do you have a bank account somewhere outside the U.S. or do you have signature authority over one? And if you do, you got to file this form. So it's like it doesn't take a rocket scientist to answer those two questions. So bottom line, yeah, they've not done well. ServiceNow believing that that's true, they're not going to make sure everybody's been told that they're supposed to do something with this by having this question here. And what they're going to hope for is that people, you know, decide, well, they'll never catch me because it's anonymous, quote unquote. By the way, it's anonymous, kind of. That's part of the problem. If you're going to try to rely on that, some people have discovered relying on that doesn't work so well sometimes. But secondly, then they'll be able to hang them for having, essentially, here it shows intent. And the problem in this case is it will be intent to evade tax, which is a criminal issue. So, you know, that could be a major problem there. And, you know, the courts have been good with this. The forms, therefore, contain. Now, in addition to this question, though, this schedule still contains the additional income items like Schedule E. If you have that, you attach Schedule 1. It contains any other unusual items of income that just aren't normally on the return. And then it contains all the adjustments to income. Now, the question there, here's the key. That question has to be answered by the taxpayer anytime you have to file Schedule 1. So you have to make an entry on any of the lines on Schedule 1. You have to answer the question. Or the instructions also are going to tell you, we assume, because we've seen the draft versions, you have to file that form and answer the question if the answer would be yes. You know, you'd have nothing else on Schedule 1 except an answer, but you answer the question yes, then you have to file it. So bottom line, your organizers should have some questions about to inquire of people about whether they have been involved in virtual currency. And I would probably make sure my question said, for example, Bitcoin, you know, and or some Bitcoin, you know, Monero, all of those other weird coins, you know, that you could have. You know, have you been involved in any of those this year? And see what the answer is. Also, don't assume your clients haven't been involved in it. I think it's kind of like the foreign bank account question. Every so often, I'm shocked when somebody tells me they have one. And they go like, why do you have one? And you discover some answer that you would never have suspected. So don't be surprised if some of your clients have been involved in virtual currency but never told you anything because, well, as far as they're concerned, you never asked about it. And number two, they never got a 1099. And number three, if you did ask about it, they never read the organizer anyway. So, yeah, I always have that piece of fun. Well, we're going to do one more year, something we've done the last few years. Notice 2019-63 issued on December the 2nd. The IRS is again going to allow insurance companies and employers to distribute the form 1095-B and 1095-C late. Remember, per the Affordable Care Act, these are supposed to be issued to employees by the end of January. Under this ruling, we will get an extension to March 2nd of 2020 to issue these forms. Now, the interesting part about this, though, unlike past years, remember, the employee doesn't necessarily need this in order to have to prove that they had qualifying coverage, right? That's not, remember, the penalty for not having qualifying coverage is now back to zero. So it's less of a problem than it was. So the IRS is considering what they should do about that. Do they have anything they can do? But they do note the law still requires you to file the form, provide the form. So what they've added is, and I should say for very certain, note, this does not extend the time for filing the forms with the IRS. And two clarifications there. First, there is a provision in the regulations to ask for an extension of time to give employees these forms or give insured these forms. The IRS says because they're already doing a blanket extension that's as long as what you could have asked for under the regulation, you can't ask for an extension of the regulation beyond March 2nd. Secondly, they said we're not extending the time to file these with the IRS, which is also going to be about the same day. However, you can still ask for that extension if you have reasonable cause for needing it. So they're saying that's involved there. But remember, we're not changing the time. You don't push the filing with the IRS back a month. That's not really how it works at this point. They also have a special relief because, as we said, we don't need these forms for the 1040s this year. So what they're going to say is you're required to have them anyway. So in this case, if it's a 1095-B that we're talking about, you can get out of this for failing to furnish that to your insureds as long as two conditions are true. If the reporting entity, generally an insurance company, posts a notice prominently on its website stating that that you can get a copy of this if you want it, right? You've got to also provide an email address, a physical address, as well as a telephone number that somebody can contact you and say, I want a copy of the form. And you have to provide that form to them within 30 days after they request it. But you don't have to mail them all out. Now, why might somebody want a copy of the form? My guess is going to be they didn't keep track of their medical insurance this year because they figured they always got this form anymore that tells them what it was. So you may find some people want it anyway. But there is an action. If you want to rely on that, it's called the 2019 Section 6055 furnishing relief. That is furnishing it to them, to the covered person. Note that this is only a one-year-only program right now. The IRS is looking at what else might do in the future. So essentially, you know, be careful here. Also, the IRS warns that this relief does not extend to Form 1095-C issued for a self-insured plan by an employer or any other plan by the employer. And they also tell us we're still going to kind of like continue on with allowing you good faith relief for having gotten some of the things wrong. They discussed that in the ruling if you're filing the form. Finally, this week, wanted to point out, the IRS has issued a 66-page memorandum on procedures for the BBA exam. This is LB&I memo, LB&I large business and International Memo 04-1019-010, but it is joint with the Small Business Self-Employed Division. This was issued actually back on October 31st, but published this week. It is a 66 published, I should say, to the public, not the agents have had it since, for, you know, since the end of October, but we get a look at it this week. It is a 66-page memorandum. The memorandum goes into various sections, right? They talk about this. A couple of interesting facts in here. One thing they note, they talk about math error rules and partnerships, and note that they're still going to use the BBA's, you know, imputed underpayment. They're going to send the math error computation out with the imputed underpayment amount for billing for taxes. But they will say it will not be considered to be a full-blown exam, so it won't be a notice of final partnership adjustment under 6231A3. But it will still come under the BBA regime. So you'll still see that if there's a math error. So if some way they find out the partnership maybe made just a straight-up math error, or it failed to report something on 1099s, etc. Yeah, they're going to be using those procedures that's mentioned in there. They have discussions there about what they can do for a partnership that's in bankruptcy, and they have things they can and cannot do. They also have the issue of how the service is going to determine if a partnership is no longer in existence. At that point, any liability will go out to the partners there at the end. And so they'll talk about how that would do. They said it will consider cease to exist if it terminates within the meaning of 708B1. That generally means we distributed all the assets and we're gone, traditional termination you might think of. But it's also going to count if the partnership simply does not have the ability to pay in full any amount due. That is, it's not collectible. That'll also be a no longer existence partnership. They also have a discussion there about what's going to be considered a partnership-related item under the BBA regime. Remember, we spent all kinds of time trying to figure that out when we were looking at the old TEFRA partnership regime. We're going to have the same problem here, same issues. They have a discussion about the secondary taxes and aren't part of BBA. So we'll talk about the special steps they're going to take if there's a self-employment tax issue or if there is a net investment income tax issue, because they talk about some of the odd ways that the statutes work in those cases. They also talk about electing out. If a partnership is elected out, one of the things the auditor is going to want to do initially is figure out for sure if that election out is valid. And they discuss some of the ways they do it. They remind you that a non-filer can never elect out because it has to be on a timely filed return. A constructive or de facto partnership would be subject to the regime because it would not have made a timely election. So, you know, that's going to also be a problem. They also remind you to look at the eligibility and whether they could be it. They remind us as well that an S-corporation, if it has any QSST or ESBT shareholders that would make them ineligible if they were direct partners, that doesn't factor into the structure. Knowing partnerships that have Q-subs are not permitted to elect out. That's kind of interesting. If you have a beneficiary's estate, they said, you know, a statutory 1041 may issue K-1s to beneficiaries. Similarly, it may have beneficiaries would be ineligible if they were direct partners. These, again, don't factor into it. It also reminds us of the list of things that cannot be partners if an opt-out's going. Like, you can't have a partnership as a partner or an LLC. You can't have any type of trust, including a grantor trust. Can't have a foreign entity that would not be taxed as a C-corporation if it was domestic. Cannot have a disregarded entity for federal tax purposes that are as a partner. You can't have an estate of an individual other than a deceased partner as a partner, nor can you have a nominee. All of those are issues. They have a discussion there, which we came up in the regs, if you remember, as we've discussed in the past, the multiple revocation problems, when they have essentially multiple revocations, more than one revocation of partnership representative in 90 days, that probably means, and they remind them kind of in this rule, that was put in there primarily so they would have a, you know, reasonable administration of the audit. That is, if the partners are fighting and they're just going to keep revoking each other, we're not going to go through that tit for tat. We're just going to stop it. So you do remind it in this place, the goals confect, you know, effective examinations. They said if they do get two revocations in the 90-day period, they want to investigate the why on that. And if there's a legitimate reason for the why, don't worry about ignoring the second one. Just go ahead and accept it. You know, they're going to say, remember, the point of this is And they don't quite openly say it, but let's be honest. The point of this is, if the partners are fighting, that's when you want to pull the, that's when IRS wants to step in, say, sorry, guys, we're stopping this right now. We're going to appoint a PR, and you're not going to be allowed to undo that PR, right? We're just going to be there. It discusses the proper use of power of attorneys. Power of attorney cannot be used to appoint a partnership representative, but the PR signs for power of attorney, and then you as the, you know, CPA, EA, or attorney can go ahead and represent the PR. You're technically representing the PR in this case, partnership representative, who's the party that has the right to act on behalf of the partnership. That's kind of how you do it. There are some nice examples about how adjustments get grouped. Like, for instance, the clear discussion that, let's say, you know, we have a problem that we allocated too much income to partner A and not enough to partner B. Well, so we should allocate more income to B. They note that you can't net those two adjustments. So there'll be an imputed underpayment on the amount allocated back to partner B, and then partner A will be separated out. And assuming we're not doing a push out on everything, the partner A adjustment will have to be taken care of in the year, you know, in the year the exam ends by the partnership. So we'll have a real weird mismatching there. So be aware of that. There's a good example of that here for the BBA exams, how that'll work. They talk about what can be grouped, what can't be. They're relatively simple examples, but you know, they're not really the most complicated problem you'd have with grouping. But they are interesting from that perspective as to how the grouping system will work and how we expect it to work. It is, as I said, we're getting to the end of the fall CPE season. We're going to get here. You know, we've got now, and the way this tends to work, to be totally honest, we all know this. Most people don't want to take continuing education courses the last half of December. So right now, these 2 weeks, you know, this week and next week are the big pair of weeks for continuing education. I'm doing some sessions, basically in-house sessions I'm going to be doing in this coming period, in this week. Also going to be doing one live session this week. And I want to remind you of that if you're going to be near Rocky Hill, Connecticut. That's basically just outside of Hartford. I'm going to be doing an Assisting the Survivors of the Seasons Estate session there. We'll talk about that on the 12th of December. So if you're going to be in that area, I'm going to be doing that there. I'll be bouncing around doing some taping for Kaplan for other programs they do. I will also, therefore, I'll be there doing this. I'll be doing some sessions for a firm there. So we have lots of things going on. I'll be in Connecticut this week, and I'm watching to see how the temperature will start out decent and then end up much less decent by the time I get close to the end of this. So I'll be moving around between various cities. I'll be moving around inside Connecticut and then end up near basically in Armonk, New York, at Kaplan's offices there to do some work, and then get back out of it and come back to Phoenix, and I'm done traveling through the end of December. That's great. The following week, I will have a pair of courses here in Phoenix, and this will be offered both live and if you want to sign up for it online by webinar. The first course on the 16th, we'll have 2 4-hour courses, one with the Arizona Accountancy Ethics. As you all know, in Arizona, if you're licensed by Arizona, you need to have an Arizona Ethics course every 2 years. That ethics course has to have certain requirements. We have those requirements in our course. We have 1 hour dealing with Arizona statutes, 1 hour dealing with the AICPA rules. Actually, we tend to go a little bit more in both, but we'll take care of that. We focus it on the tax side. That's the idea of our ethics. By the way, flip side of that, if you're not in Arizona, we don't know if this will qualify for your state's ethics or not. Actually, I think there are a few that are still open with ethics. It may very well qualify. But if your state has specific requirements, the odds are this is not going to fulfill them. And no, this doesn't work if you are an enrolled agent, because this is going to have to cover things that are very, very specific to the state and accounting rules. And it's not going to cover CERC 230 as the entire 4 hours. So yeah, it doesn't work there either. Arizona income taxes. We're going to do an update and overview of Arizona income tax rules. We'll take a look at that. We're going to explain what happens with what they passed this year and how it's going to affect the returns for this year. So it'd be an interesting discussion. On the 17th, we're going to do a full 8 hours that day on current federal tax developments, what happened in the year, you know, the past year. And I kind of look at this, and as I've said when I've taught this all this year, I look at this mainly as what's happened since the final regs came out on 109 Cap A at the start of last tax season, because we all spent a lot of time on that. But there's been lots of things happened since then, so we want to kind of discuss what's happened since that point, what's going on, talk a little bit about cases, and a little bit outside federal, too. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what happened with trust taxation at the state level, talk about the Kastner case and the Fielding cases, and, you know, how they impact our problem with states, and have sort of a general discussion of the pain the states have become. And we'll get down there. But those are all signed up. You can sign up for that at the Arizona Society of CPAs website. Again, either live, come down and see us here at the Society's offices in Phoenix, or you can take it, you know, you can remote take it, you know, and just take it from the comfort of your home. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 9th. You can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to have questions or comments, you can email them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Nice place to grab them. You know, I do know there that it relates to the CPE style programs. It's a lot better place to put them. I realize I have other addresses. I realize a lot of people know those other addresses, but it's a lot safer to send email questions there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm there at Ed Zollers is my location. If you want to follow discussions on a subreddit, I do on Reddit, go on /r/taxpros. As I mention every week, I also follow discussions on three state societies, the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey Connect sites. So if you're posting on Connect, I keep an eye somewhat on what goes on those sites and try to respond if I think I have something to add. I also will look in from time to time to the Tax Talk discussion group run by CalCPA. That one is open to anybody around the country. It's a little messier to get into, so if you want to, you can drop me an email if you want to try to get into CalCPA stuff, and I'll dig up the stuff to figure out how you can make your request to get in there. You should be approved as long as you're licensed in, you know, basically in one of the states. You should be there. Shouldn't be a problem, but it's a little more complicated because they had to move off of Yahoo Groups. But as that stands, I said, I'm going to be on the road for the week, so this will be an interesting week to write things on. But I do have some downtime, though, during the week, so probably, I think I should have no problem getting things written this week. I'll say that and hope I'm right about getting that done. So hopefully we'll get everything together. We'll be right here on time next week when I get back in and hopefully finally get awake after returning about the middle of the night before for that. And so hopefully we'll see you here as we get closer and closer to the end of this year and closer and closer. All these forms mean tax season is upon us almost, and we want to get ready for this, and or maybe we don't, but it doesn't matter. It's going to come anyway. So go ahead, tune back in, watch us here next week here at Current Federal Tax Developments.